Hello, I'm Richard Black. Welcome to Science in Action. In this edition, life in other parts of the solar system, how it could breathe and how we could look for it. The exciting long-term prospects for a very special gene.
Using this gene, we believe that we could transform any stem cells into such building blocks which then could be used to form pancreatic cells or liver cells to cure diabetes or liver diseases.
And proof that researchers draw inspiration from the most unlikely sources.
I admire spaghetti, and one day eating lunch, I just try to tie a knot on it and break it.
First, away from such domestic concerns and into space, and an exciting idea for exploring one of the objects in the solar system where it's thought possible that life could exist. It's not a planet, but a moon of Jupiter, Europa. What excites scientists about Europa is that under its surface of solid ice, there could well be an ocean of liquid water. Over the past few years, NASA's space probe Galileo has discovered fluctuations in Europa's magnetic field, fluctuations which suggest there's a liquid which conducts electricity sloshing around under the moon's surface. That liquid is highly likely to be salty water. Anything else really would be extraordinary. Nick McCreese from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology has come up with an intriguing way of exploring what's really happening on and in Europa using sound. He's been testing his ideas in the Arctic, which also consists of solid ice and salty ocean, and he presented the concept this week at the annual meeting of the Acoustical Society of America. After his presentation, Nick went through it all again for Science in Action.
Now, our job would eventually be something like 20 years from now, would be to put some microphones or geophones on the surface of this moon and try to use sound waves or seismic sources to infer what the structure of the moon is.
What might be producing these sound waves?
Well, if you look at the surface of Europa from the orbiting images, you see that the surface is covered with cracks, okay, fractures that run all over the surface of the moon. And it turns out that if you look at a finer scale sort of image, you see that these fractures exist even at these smaller scale. And the question is, what is causing these fractures? Well, it turns out that Europa orbits around Jupiter in an elliptical rather than a perfect circular orbit. And this causes tidal stresses on the surface of Europa.
So these tidal forces are pushing and pulling Europa. And by doing that, the surface is continually cracking and healing and then cracking again.
Yes, and that's the interesting thing. You probably have to get on the surface of the moon to see cracks that are being formed, say, on a daily basis, if they are being formed on a daily basis.
But you think if you could put enough microphones on the surface, you could actually hear these cracks
being formed on a daily basis? That's exactly the situation. And we believe that because the orbit around Jupiter is only 3.5 days, that it's probably cracking on a daily basis.
So if you're right, and if you could pick up all this cracking, is that going to tell you then? Is that going to answer this question about whether there really is a liquid ocean under the ice?
Okay. Well, what that leads us to is the following. The way we know what the ocean is like on Earth, the way we know what how deep the ocean is on Earth is with sound waves. You cannot see through the ocean very well. The light doesn't propagate well through water. And so we use sound waves. You set a sound source off, and by travel time, you wait for the echoes to from the bottom of the ocean, and you can estimate, based on the sound speed and the travel time, what the range is to the bottom of the ocean. And so here on Europa, the same thing would be done, but using natural cracking sources. And so we would do echo sounding off of the different layers. And the important layers that we would look for, first it would be the ice water layer, if there is indeed a water layer with a liquid ocean. And then the next one would be a reflection off of the ocean layer and the core of the planet.
If your concept does become reality, how many microphones are you going to need, and how are you going to get them onto the surface of Europa?
Well, you can probably get a good idea of whether you're getting cracks at all with a single microphone, and that's the essential thing. And it's a type of work we did in the Arctic Ocean on Earth, that we placed microphones under the water in the Arctic Ocean, and we found that with its orbit and these tidal bulges, the next thing we would do is try to isolate individual cracking features, individual events. And so it's potentially possible with a single microphone, but it's probably a lot more robust to use more microphones, because then you can triangulate cracks and their echoes in more unique ways.
Obviously, you've got some of the big these cracks are and how they behave. Would you care to give us an impression of what you think Europa might sound like?
Wow, that's a tough one. Imagine you and I talking here, in fact, in the room as we are. And then imagine there's 10 other interviewers asking me questions at the same time. All right? I'm not going to be able to pick that signal out. All right? So if you've got all these cracking events going on in Europa all the time, you're going to have a hard time sorting out the cracking events from the echoes returning off of the ice water interfaces. And you're going to have a hard time using this information to study the structure of the moon. So there is a problem if there's too much cracking. I actually think that it's probably a pretty noisy place. One of the scientists, the NASA scientist, said Europa is going to be creaking like a ship. I think it's going to be a very noisy environment.
Nick McCreese from Boston. But although our earthly experience that liquid water is for life, it isn't sufficient. Life also needs oxygen. Here on Earth, despite the best efforts of the forestry industry, most organisms get their oxygen from photosynthesis. But that can't be the answer for Europa. It's too far from the sun. So what could life there use? That's a question which Chris's team have been pondering at the SETI Institute in California, SETI being the acronym for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and they published their thoughts this week in the journal Science. Europa is constantly being bombarded with highly energetic particles, and one of the ideas is that these could break down water molecules and make oxygen this way. Well, rather handily, my colleague Martin Redfern has just been visiting the SETI Institute, where Chris Chiver told him about what he thinks is an even better idea.
Europa appears to have, we infer that from the magnetometer measurements from the craft. One of the salts that should be in Europa's ocean is potassium. Potassium decays. That is, one of the isotopes of potassium is radioactive. Potassium-40, and when potassium-40 decays either via a gamma ray or a beta particle, it will split water molecules into oxygen and hydrogen. So you can imagine over geological periods of time a slow production of the sort of fuel oxidant pairs that that life needs to make a living from. There will also be production of oxidants within the ice itself, because the ice has incorporated a certain amount of potassium. And the potassium-40 in that potassium decays and produces oxidants right in the deep ice. But also there'll be decay in the ocean itself, which will split molecules, split water molecules right there in the ocean.
You're talking in terms of life as we know it, and that means carbon-based. Is the carbon on Europa?
There's a little bit of evidence from the Galileo spacecraft for some carbon-based molecules on the surface, hydrogen cyanide, for example, which contains carbon. Everyone assumes that there are carbon on Europa because satellites throughout the outer solar system contain carbon. Meteorites are rich in carbon. Comets are rich in carbon. But, you know, Europa formed close to Jupiter. And it could be that in the area, the volume of space where Europa formed near Jupiter, that there was very little carbon available to be incorporated into a world. But even if that happened, Europa has had 4 billion years of comet collisions. And work that I've been doing with Elisabetta Piarrazza at the University of Arizona in the United States suggests that enough of that carbon would have been retained by Europa, despite the high speeds of the comet collisions, that even if Europa had formed without any carbon at all, there would be enough carbon to support a biosphere.
And when you do the sums, albeit they have to be at least estimates, if not guesses, how does it all add up? The energy, the carbon, the oxygen, how much life could there be?
Well, you're right to say that this is all very speculative. Our estimates suggest that you could support a biosphere of microorganisms on Europa that is a fraction of the biosphere in the Earth's oceans. But the lower end of our estimates suggests that you could produce, say, 10 million kilograms of biomass per year in Europa's ocean. But the only way we're really going to know the answer to that question is to actually go there, first with an orbiter, then with a lander. You don't need to drill through the ice. You can probably sample the ocean indirectly by landing at a spot where it appears as though liquid water has emerged and flooded onto the surface. You'd want to dig down a bit into that ice. The liquid water won't stay liquid long. It'll freeze very quickly on the surface. But you'd want to dig or drill down into that ice and then melt it and see what's in it. So the way to answer these questions is to go there and find out.
And I guess at the end of all that, the big question you'll want to answer, particularly since this is the SETI Institute, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, is whether any life you find up there is similar in its makeup to our own, or whether it's evidence of a second genesis.
One of the most important reasons for searching for life elsewhere in our solar system is to get insights into the origin of life. Is there only one way to do it, or are there many very different ways to originate life? With Europa, we have a very good chance of coming to a world that may harbor life, and if Europa does harbor life, it's probably a kind of life that is not related to our own. It would be fascinating to see just what that life looks like.
The question which always arises in my mind with this issue is that if you suppose that life on Europa or anywhere else isn't like our own, then why do we assume it needs water? It's probably best left to another occasion. That was Chris Chiber with Martin Redfern. You're listening to Science in Action from the BBC in London. Still to come, how plants from the rainforest are providing what may be the perfect pesticide. Time to turn our attention now, though, to the developing embryo. Whether you think of humans or kangaroos or birds or fish or whatever, it's one of nature's most extraordinary stories. How a small blob of seemingly identical cells is transformed into all the different specialized bits which make the fully formed animal. This week, scientists in California report in the journal Genes and Development that they've identified a crucial part of the puzzle, a gene which directs cells to become a particular type of tissue called three distinct varieties of tissue. They've used zebrafish for their research, but say there's strong evidence that they're in humans. Team leader Didier Stainier told me more about this special gene, which they've named Casanova.
Right, so the function of this gene is endoderm formation. And so endoderm is one of three germ layers in the early embryo. As you know, the ectoderm will form the nervous system and the skin, the mesoderm will give rise to the heart and the kidney, and the endoderm will give rise to the pancreas and the liver, for example.
So the turning on of this one gene selects a certain bit of tissue to become endoderm?
That's correct. And in the absence, you lack endoderm completely.
Endoderm itself can become a number of different tissues in the body.
That's right. So it will give rise to the gut, the lining of the lungs, the pancreas, thymus. So it plays a very important role in our internal organs.
Once Casanova has done its thing and you've got a patch of endoderm, what then happens to them becomes lung lining or gut or whatever?
Right. So that's a very interesting question. So as you may know, there are a number of genes called homeobox genes. And these genes, there are about 48 of them in humans and in most vertebrates. Different patterns of expression along the anterior-posterior axis of the embryo, that is from the head to the tail, and different combinations of these genes will give you different anterior-posterior identity, so that at the first third of the embryo, you form the head, and so if you think about the endoderm, then you'll form the mouth and the lining of the mouth. And a slightly more posterior, different combination of Hox genes, homeobox to the lungs and so on. So that's the concept at this point.
Once you have got this information then, you know what goes on, you know what it then goes on to do, what practical uses do you think might come out of this?
Right, so one aspect of the work is the fact that this gene is necessary for endoderm formation, so in its absence we lack all endoderm. The other important aspect of the work is that if we express this gene in cells, that normally we can transform them into endoderm. And so essentially what we're doing here is taking cells that are, if you wish, naive, and we transform them into endoderm. And so, of course, endoderm is the building block of hepatocytes, liver cells, as well as the pancreas cells, which produce insulin. And so using this gene, we believe that we could transform any stem cells into a building block, and which then could be used to form pancreatic cells or liver cells to cure diabetes or liver diseases.
Would you be envisaging the use of this in adults or perhaps in young children or perhaps even before birth when some kind of genetic deficiency has been identified?
I guess I wouldn't rule anything out at this point, but I think the most practical and direct applications of this gene would be to use it first in tissue culture and to take stem cells and then transform them into endodermal cells. And then once people identify the genes that will regulate the differentiation of endodermal cells into pancreatic cells or liver cells, then this gene can be put in these endodermal cells, and then the pancreatic cells or the liver cells put back, injected back into either an adult or a child which has, who has liver disease or pancreatic diabetes, for example.
How far away do you think this vision might be?
I think, you know, what we've done in our work is take it to, you know, one step. We can make now endoderm from stem cells, so the next step is then to identify the gene that's responsible for, to take endoderm and make it pancreatic cell. And, you know, there's several of many laboratories around the world that are working to get this gene, and certainly we're getting a lot of information on this. So, you know, one can never put time into this, but I imagine that within 5 to 10 years, you'll really be able to direct and control very tightly the differentiation of stem cells to make pancreatic cells.
Didier Stanier from the University of California at San Francisco. And in case you're wondering, they called their gene Casanova because animals without it have a split heart. Whoever said scientists don't have a sense of humor. Chemical pesticides may kill little creatures attacking your crops, but many do other unwanted and unpleasant things. Well, time then to look to nature for some different ideas about how to keep plants pest-free. And in Costa Rica, nature has provided one. Ros Smith reports.
Over 400 billion cups of coffee are consumed each year, making it one of the most popular drinks worldwide. Many pests and diseases can affect the coffee crop, and one of the most destructive is invasion of the roots by tiny worms called nematodes. Until now, the best ways of combating the pests have not been ideal. Dr. Giselle Tamayo from the Institute of Biodiversity in Costa Rica.
When you have an infection of nematodes, you have an impact on production, and you have also an impact on the health of the plant. The traditional way of getting rid of the nematodes is applying very toxic chemicals that are very toxic to either to the plants or to the mammals.
There are two possible methods that scientists can use to address this pest problem.
We can try to look at DNA sequences that could be incorporated in a crop, let's say banana plantations, then to produce banana plants that could have resistance to nematodes. Or we can try to find a chemical, a small molecule, that could be applied to the plant and that has these certain effects of being nematicidal.
Rather than using DNA, it is this chemical method that scientists have been working on. They have discovered that this new nematode-killing molecule might come from a natural source, a tropical legume tree that produces seeds that are packed full of useful compounds. Nick Birch is from the Scottish Crops Research Institute in Dundee.
The original work was done by a very famous tropical ecologist called Dan Jansen, who spent most of his life actually in Costa Rica. He noticed that the seeds of this particular tree were hardly ever eaten by insects or rodents. And from that original observation, he then linked up with plant chemists at Kew, who looked at the chemistry of this tree and found it contained some very unusual compounds.
One of these compounds was DMDP.
DMDP stands for a very long chemical name, which would take me about 3 minutes to read out. But in fact, what it really is a sugar analog. That means it's a molecule which has a very similar shape to fructose, which is a simple sugar. But instead of having oxygen in the ring, it has a nitrogen. And because it has lots of other hydroxy groups around the edge, it's very water soluble, so it has many interesting properties. It is poisonous to many pests, but it's the most interesting property is that it acts as what we call an ant.
What the scientists then found was that when you spray DMDP onto the leaves at very low doses, it actually protects the roots of the plants from the nematodes. But how does it do it?
Yeah, it doesn't act like a normal synthetic pesticide. It doesn't kill the nematodes quickly. What it seems to do is interfere with the way that they find their plant and how they actually invade the plant and feed. So it acts in several ways. The exact mechanism isn't known, but because it's very similar in shape to a sugar, it probably binds to sugar receptors on the nematode and confuses them so they don't...
So by confusing the worms, farmers should be able to protect their crops without having to use toxic pesticides. Welcome relief to coffee farmers like Edgar Alpiza, who's been trialing DMDP in Costa Rica.
Well, with this product, we obtain more coffee, better quality, and also we are seeing that there is an improvement in the coffee roots because we have to put chemicals every year, sometimes twice in a year. DMP we are only have to apply like for 2 years, and then you don't have to worry for nematodes.
That report from Ross Smith. Wet spaghetti might not be every scientist's idea of the perfect research tool, but it's proved to be the answer to a pretty knotty problem. Giovanni Dietler, now at the University of Lausanne in Switzerland, but originally from Italy, and Piotr Pianski from Poznan University in Poland, have been trying to see what happens when a knot in a piece of rope breaks. They first try to record what happens with a super-fast camera, stretching and stretching a strand until it broke. So what, Giovanni, was the problem?
This camera takes 1,000 frames per second, but when we were using a fishing line, we could not see the breakage of the knot.
So one frame the knot's intact and the next frame it's exploded already?
Exactly, yes. We would just see the knot without any modification, and 1 second later the field of view was just black.
Having realized that then that you couldn't use ordinary rope and string, you were scouting around for another material. And Piotr, I gather it was your idea, was it, to try and look at spaghetti? Why?
Well, because I admire spaghetti, and one day eating lunch, I just try to tie a knot on it and break it. And then what I noticed was that this material first breaks relatively easily. Seemingly or apparently this process was slow, so I transmitted this remark to Andrzej Stasiak, the third main member of the team, and he contacted Giovanni, and Giovanni started to do the experiments.
I see. Now, Giovanni, can you describe exactly how you did the experiments then?
Well, I went to the Army Lab in Switzerland, which has this very fast camera, and then I brought with me some uncooked spaghetti and some salt and some olive oil. And then there in the lab, we just cooked the spaghetti and made these knots and made the video recording in the Army Lab.
I see. And you can see the spaghetti distorting, can you, and then breaking?
Yes. I could pull by hand very gently the knot, and then the breakage will take enough time to be recorded exactly by the camera.
Now, is this just ordinary spaghetti, Giovanni, or do you have to cook it in some special way or mix any extra ingredient in?
Well, at first, as my Italian origins concerns, I started to cook them al dente.
Right.
But then we noticed that the breakage would occur at random inside the knot, not at a well-defined place.
Now, Piotr, what is exactly that point? Where exactly does the spaghetti break?
This was the problem. My part in this project was to make some computer simulations of the process of tightening knots. I wrote a program which simulates a perfect rope on which a knot is tied, and then the rope is pulled by its ends.
And do you see the same thing happening in real life with the spaghetti?
Yes, yes, yes. What we have found out that the point at which spaghetti knot breaks is the point located exactly in the same place in which there are the peaks of the curvature which I find in my sessions.
Giovanni, of course it's wonderful to involve such an important part of the culture of your homeland in a scientific experiment, but what use do you think this actually is?
Well, the use, if I think about spaghetti, would be to test the quality of the spaghetti, maybe, by this method. But the most important points are related to polymer physics, to biology, and to material science. This will help to design better ways to use ropes to make fabrics, for example, because the idea behind this work is to show where the knot breaks and why it breaks, and then this will give information to the scientist who tries to make better materials what to do.
If I could add something, well, at the same time, we could predict which knots are more dangerous than others, because when you simulate a knot in a computer, you see exactly its curvature profile, and then looking at the profile, you are able to predict if the peaks of the curvature are too high, if they are dangerous. So computer simulations could give some information on the safety of different types of knots.
It seems that you've also come up with something which school children could use to explore the properties of materials. I mean, you could use spaghetti in Europe or noodles in East Asia, whatever.
Of course. I gave a talk last summer to a conference, And I can tell you that everybody in the evening after the conference was eating spaghetti in the restaurant and were trying out these experiments. So our hope is that this will be one of the most reproduced experiments in the whole physics field.
Probably a good idea if you scrape the sauce off first, though. Those epicures of the scientific table were Piotr Priyansky and Giovanni Dietler. Time for us to pay up and leave now, but do join me for another feast in the food halls of science at the same time next week.
Science in Action was presented by Richard Black and produced by Pam Rutherford. Dinosaurs first evolved on Earth about 230 million years ago, but in a sense they weren't really created until the mid-19th century when an Englishman invented the word dinosaur. The Great Dinosaur Hunt, the history of dinosaur discovery, starting next Friday and Monday week in the World Insight Hour.